Hey everyone, this is Sarah Chen Spellings. Welcome to another episode of Billion Dollar Moves, where every week it is my job to deconstruct the billion dollar moves of some of the top founders and funders in the US and Asia venture ecosystem. What typically got them from their journey of underestimated to iconic in the most raw and unfiltered form. You won't get this anywhere else. Due to popular requests, since many of my episodes I know are a little bit long, this season I'll be serving up recaps at the end of every month. It features my quick thoughts on the top three things that left an impression on me and a short clip from each conversation in one place so you can get a feel of both the episode and the guest, and you can always dig deeper, which of course I highly recommend, by going to the actual episodes themselves, which will be listed in the show notes. Now let's get started. All right, first up, Egyptian-American technologist Rana El Kaliobi, founder of Effectiva, an emotion AI startup that sold her company for $73.5 million last year. The top three lessons that left an impression on me were... Number one, decoupling your identity from your startup. Now, this is an interesting topic and one that I know I've struggled with, being so career-focused in that I associated not just my identity, but my worth with how well I'm doing at work. Rana shares how hard that actually is when you spend so much of your life invested into an idea, building that up, and then, quote unquote, giving away your baby.
And I am going to be quite vulnerable in my answer to this. First of all, I felt a lot of guilt. I felt like I was giving in, you know, selling out on my baby, because Effectiva is like my baby. And what I've come to realize that it's not selling out. It is graduating to a new chapter, right? So my daughter, you know, just turned 18 and she just started college. And so we moved her into her dorm and I haven't given up on her. It's just a new form of our relationship, right? And we exited at exactly the same time when she was graduating high school. And it's the same with Effectiva. We haven't sold out, but we are starting a new chapter for this journey. You know, Effectiva lives on, and now we're part of this bigger company and we have more, you know, power to go make things happen. So that's kind of point number one, just kind of put it in perspective. I think that's really key. Second is be kind to yourself, right? I don't know that I'm totally burnt out because I love what I do, but a big part of me was thinking about the opportunity cost as well, right? Like I want to do a lot of other things. I want to serve on boards. I want to help young founders, young as in early in their journey, help them, you know, find their path and support them, especially overlooked founders. This gave me an opportunity to, I guess, free up some of my brain cycles and my time to explore some of these other venues.
Lesson number two, don't be afraid to outgrow your dreams. While Rana's biggest dream was to become a professor, the tide changed quickly. Her research at MIT on emotional AI with global thought leader Ross Picard on effective computing caught commercial attention from big names long before it was commercial ready. She saw how transformative this technology could be at scale. AI that understands human emotion or cognitive states by analyzing our facial expressions. How cool is that? She knew she would regret not at least trying to see this vision through. Do the thing that scares you.
So you know, I always talk about outgrowing your dreams because to me, it was very interesting. My dream was to go back home and become faculty. But once I got to Cambridge and then built this emotionally intelligent machine, and actually towards the end of my PhD, again, very serendipitously met Ross Picard in person. She was visiting Cambridge, giving a talk, and wanted to meet with some PhD students. And she and I met up and just totally hit it off. And she said, why don't you come work with me as a postdoc? And of course, I was like, oh, this is like a dream come true. So I joined her lab as a postdoc, still thinking it's academia. But very quickly at MIT, it became apparent that there was so much commercial interest in the technology. And we had like at least 20 Fortune 500 companies wanting to buy, you know, our solution. And this was research code. So we didn't really have a mechanism to give it to the Pepsis of the world or the Bank of America's. And so in 2009, she and I decided to co-found Effectiva. She stayed as an MIT professor, and I basically kind of switched career from academia to industry and grew the company and, you know, finance, you know, brought in venture capitalists. And so it's been an incredible, for me, actually, what was the tipping point of going from academia to industry was realizing I have a very perhaps unique opportunity to bring technology to the world at scale, because academia is usually not at scale. And I felt like that could be, you know, quite transformative.
Yeah. And it's that thought. I think what you're speaking to, I've heard many said before, is that the biggest fear, if that could be the right word, is that the missed opportunity of not bringing that to the world.
Lesson number three, when accepting money, watch the power leverage. Not every check is made equal. Rana and her team took an investment from big ad player WPP, who also had a board seat. While it was strategic, of course, they agreed to an exclusivity term, which meant that Affectiva could not work with their biggest competitors. 10 years on, after the check was written, this still remains the case. The message? Think carefully about who you bring on as investors and their agenda and their definition of success. Let me repeat that. Not every check is made equal. Boom.
What was your strategy? And admittedly, before a big exit, many companies had raised a lot more than you have before that point of exit, right?
Right.
It was part of a decision. Talk to us about that strategy, though.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, a consideration. For example, we have a combination of venture, you know, investors, but we also have strategic investors. And even that decision, when do you take strategic money versus venture money? That's like a big decision. When we raised our round in 2011, when we turned that big, you know, $40 million check and instead focused on finding other investors, we took money in from WPP, their big advertising conglomerate, and they ended up being our biggest client and partner. So they are both an equity investor, but they're also very strategic. And they accelerated bringing our product to literally 90 countries around the world in less than 6 months. It was amazing from a business standpoint. But what I guess I underestimated when we took the money from them is that they had a lot of leverage over us, right? They were on our board. You know, there was some exclusivity in place, so we couldn't work with their biggest competitors. We still can't work with their biggest competitors 10 years on. So who you bring on as investors and their agenda and their definition of success, like our strategics don't care about valuation. They're not valuation sensitive at all, but they do care about the business partnership. Our venture investors very much care about dilution and valuation and all of that. And so it's just a very different lens on the business. And knowing, you know, as a CEO or a founder that you will have different constituents with different agendas, that's really key, because then you can navigate it, I guess, and be more informed.
Hold that thought. Teams everywhere are dealing with a serious problem, a productivity problem. But don't worry, HubSpot's customer platform can help. No more time-consuming tasks, no more chasing down prospect info, no more one system for this, another for that. HubSpot helps you find leads, reach prospects, and deliver the insights to convert them into customers all in one place, making your productivity problem no problem at all. Visit HubSpot.com to learn how they can help you grow better.
Next up, Tiwa York. Tiwa York was brought in by the likes of Naspers and Tencent to clean up their e-commerce portfolio in Thailand, which resulted in the birth of Kaidi, Thailand's largest C2C marketplace at their peak, serving 35 million users who listed close to 10 million products across 250 categories from automotive to property for sales every year. The top three lessons that left an impression on me were... Number one, listen to what's unsaid to manage in Asia. I love this one. Early in his journey, Tiwa, who despite speaking and writing Thai, being half Thai, felt often frustrated by a team that was not cooperating with him. He was later told, Tiwa, you understand the words, but you don't understand the meaning. P.S. This was told by his very, very smart wife. He realized that while he understood the language and somewhat looked the part, being half Thai, of course, he did not actually understand Thailand. Foreigners operating in Asia often misunderstand that silence displayed by teams is either they don't know or they're idiots. Most of the time, by the way, they're smart, very smart, but culturally not willing to say it to you directly.
Silence, so, stubbornness. Love it.
Yeah. So they'll talk to me, they'll say certain words, but they'll be silent and stubborn. So, okay, boss, I understand what you want me to do. I disagree with you. Fine, I'll do it if you make me do it. And I didn't understand that. My wife was the one who said, Tiwa, tell me exactly what happened. Tell me exactly what they said. And I told her exactly what they said in Thai. And she goes, you didn't understand what they said. I went, oh. And that was my first massive lesson of managing in Asia, was how do you listen to the staff? What foreigners may misunderstand is they believe silence is either they don't know or they're idiots or they're stupid. They actually don't know what to say. And actually, it turns out to be, no, they're just not willing to say it to you directly. And it's a very roundabout. I think this exists across Asia. I'm not going to tell you directly because that's disrespectful. But I'm going to tell you, in my way and you better listen to it. And I think a lot of international companies that come into the market don't get this topic. They don't understand how to navigate and understand that the language and the culture is not, it's indirect. And in fact, it's even down to the language is indirect. So Asian languages are circular. And in fact, we're unable to do, like, future perfect tense does not exist in Asian languages. You cannot say, I will have read Harry Potter next year. Those words do not exist.
Yeah.
However, in English, we go, yeah, I can place myself in the future and say, at that point in time, this will be a completed action that the book Harry Potter, I have read it. The only thing we can do in Asian language is to say, I will read Harry Potter next year. And understand the indirect about way that language works and the culture works was a big lesson for me to understand how do I better manage and listen to my team.
Lesson number two, actually embrace failure. It's easy to say we embrace failure, but it's important to intentionally build a safe space to fail. Often leaders jump immediately to problem solving or defense mode without actually listening and come off making the person who failed feel somewhat attacked. Tiwa compares the alternative of a sports team, specifically a football or a soccer team, and I absolutely love this.
Can you really allow your team to fail and really embrace that and say, understand, it's okay, not the way we expected it to be, but we'll work on it for the next time. And I think the key point that I would like to make and what I learned along the way was the difference between a working group and the way we were taught to work versus how a sports team is taught to play as a team. And I think this was my big learning was we're taught in the working environment, which, oh my gosh, this project failed. I'm going to talk about it and say why, and you got to tell me. Rather, when a sports team, they lose on Sunday, guess what? They wake up Monday, they start practicing together and working on the next game and learning from it and then fixing things to make sure they win in the next game. But we don't actually do that as businesses or as managers or leaders. And I think these are the areas that I started to work on in Thailand of A, listening to the team and then really allowing them to feel free to say, yeah, it didn't work out, boss. Sorry. And I'm like,
yeah,
I know that they didn't intend for that either, right?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, the fact that you call yourself head coach all makes sense, you know, in terms of thinking about yourself as teams versus, and I know you make a distinction between teams and working groups as well.
Lesson number three, team and working groups. Tiwa makes a differentiation between teams versus working groups and why the former is what we should strive to lead in.
And what's funny about running businesses is that you think about a football team, they spend 30 hours a week preparing to play 90 minutes. We as businesses spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week, 70 hours a week playing on the field, but never preparing for it. And it's a massive shift in how we look at our teams. And this is where we talk about working groups versus a team. A team is we come together and we know each player in the position that they play on the field. But when we're a working group, we expect to be responsible for my tasks. I'm going to get my tasks done. And when the project fails, wasn't my problem. They didn't finish their tasks. We point the finger. So if you think about it, we're talking about Premier League. If I'm playing for Liverpool, I'm the striker on the field. If I actually behave the way we behave in business on the field while playing, it would never work. And here's the example. I'm the striker. My job is to kick the ball towards the net. I wait for the midfield to send me the ball. And when it's sent to me, I will kick it towards the goal. Now, if I behave the way we behave in business, I say, I just got my job done. I kicked it towards the goal. I'm going to stand here and wait until the midfield sends me the ball again. Would that team ever win? Hell no.
Hey, we're taking a quick break here so I can tell you about this new show that just joined our network. Created, hosted by John Yushai, is brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. Created gives an insight look at how to build a business as a creator, improve your creative process, and stay ahead of the latest content trends. John Yushai, ex-YouTube and Instagram employee, breaks down the creator economy with guests like Logan Paul, Paris Hilton, Jason Derulo, Jake Paul, George Lopez, and so much more. A not-so-recent episode I loved was actually the one with Liza Koshy. Remember her? She was one of the fastest-growing YouTubers, and Viners, if you remember that, growing a fan base well beyond 25 million subscribers. But then she stopped uploading. What happened to Liza Koshy? That's a smart woman who made a drastic career decision, what I may call a billion-dollar move. You'd want to tune in to this one. Listen to Create It wherever you get your podcasts.
And finally, we have our recap of the last episode with Jamal Bujang, who was the CEO of government-owned venture firm in Malaysia with 1.5 billion assets under management, responsible for seeding what I would say the first generation of VC funds in Malaysia and building the ecosystem in quite a large way. And of course, is MD of Gobi Partners Now, a Pan-Asian venture capital firm with 1.2 billion assets under management. Now, his lessons are, number one, if you don't have trust, you don't have a deal. Well, my question to JB focused on the dynamics between co-GPs, i.e. when two parties partner to raise a fund. I really think his answer applies to all business partnerships. You know, you can design something that you believe will work the best for both parties, put in every, you know, bell and whistle, but with everything at the end of the day, you know, you don't want a relationship that's guided purely by black and white.
You can design something that can work for both parties, but look, at the end of the day, it's all about trust to begin with. Mm. It doesn't matter what economy you're going to be sharing between two of you or three of you. It's just in the future, right? It's now. It's how to make things work between you and your partner, because you're going to partner with them for the next 10 years. You're basically married for the next 10 years, right? And what do you have? What do you have? All you have is trust. That's it. Mm. And he should be doing something that you want to do. But he has also expect you to do something that he wants as well, right? So there must be constant, what do you call it, engagement between the two parties. This, like I said, I think plays a big role in it. You don't want to have a relationship that's guided by just black and white agreement. You can do this. No agreement can cover all this requirement that you want and match with what he wants. Seriously.
Lesson number two, boots on the ground. Don't believe everything you see in the media. JB shared about how, like many others, were cautious about Pakistan at first with the bad reputation the country often gets from the media. However, he took a chance by first attending a conference in Karachi and was absolutely surprised by the opportunity he saw, which led to building with Fatima Group, now the Pakistan Fund, led by Gobi.
Why don't we just go to Karachi? Have you gone to Karachi? I said, no, none of us has gone to Karachi before. Why don't we just go and maybe we get a better feel about Pakistan, about what's going on. If you read what Pakistan, if you haven't been to Pakistan, what you read in the news is not really that good, right? So we went and we were totally surprised. We were hardly any VC, foreign VC. There are only a few local VCs there, right? When we came and we met that potential company that we invested in. Also, I said, we like this company and all that.
And lesson number three, chemistry matters. A more intangible learning was that chemistry matters within a team. You know, the partnership can look great on paper, as I said in point one, but viewing at least a co-GP relationship as one that would last 10 years, the team dynamic needs to really feel right. How do you think about working with someone that actually you only met through a course, but it wasn't like your lifetime friend? How do you think about that?
Yeah, it's funny. It's a good thing you asked that as well. Between him and us, there's a complete trust between him and us. For that, I'm thankful to God. I think we found a good partner. He treats us as an equal partner, really. Whatever economics that we get from this fund, we split equally. That's how we started off. I think he's very happy with that. And he knows that we trust him as well. And we have people like Tom, who's you can easily mix with. And Tom works well with him as well. So, and I got Tariq, my colleague. He clicks very well with Ali as well. He comes from Pakistan descent as well. So, it's all there. So, I think we're just lucky.
All right, guys and gals. Well, there you have it. My Billion Dollar Moves breakdown for the first three episodes of season two. Let me know what you think, what resonated with you. Was there a lesson you picked up that I missed that I should put on the show notes? Hit me up on socials at Sarah Chen Global. And of course, don't forget to subscribe on Billion Dollar Moves and tell all your friends. See you next week and keep making Billion Dollar Moves.
And thanks so much for tuning in this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow our socials on Sarah Chen Global to get the latest on the show. It would really help me out too if you enjoyed this to rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts and share your favorite episodes with a friend. I'm Sarah Chen Spellings, and you've been listening to Billion Dollar Moves.